Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, join us for a Radio Lillooet special presentation of the exploits and triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, chess champion. A book by Frederick Milnes Edge in 5 parts.
Section 5 of The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milnes Edge. Chapter 4, Part 2. We are upon classic ground. Who does not remember the feats performed within the walls of this home of the glorious departed? Who shall forget the oft-told wonders of that golden age of chess? Anything related of the Westminster Club is swallowed with willing faith by gaping acolytes. Those were glorious days indeed, the Homeric age of zatricchiological worthies. Amongst the early supporters of the club were the Reverend Mr. D'Arblay, son of Madame D'Arblay, Mr. Skelton, so well known about town as Dandy Skelton, Mr. Nixon, organist of the Bavarian Catholic Church in Warwick Street, Duncan Forbes, professor of Oriental languages at University College, and many other celebrated literary characters. The proprietor, Mr. Hutman, followed the enterprise with spirit. Every cigar he sold in the coffee room was wrapped in a printed problem, and, in addition, he published a periodical penny miscellany on chess. Such extraordinary exertions quickly bore fruit, and, in a short time, the club rose to something like 50 members. The room in which the meetings were held became, in consequence, so hot that it was deservedly styled the oven. Emboldened by success, Mr. Hutman began to look about for new and more commodious quarters. These he eventually found on the opposite side of the street. Certain gamblers had there taken a house, and furnished the principal apartments in sumptuous style, for the sole purpose of decoying thither a young foreign nobleman who, in one night, is said to have lost there upwards of £30,000. The house, having served their diabolical ends, was of no further use to them, and Mr. Hutman rented it. Here the Westminster Club was enshrined. Amongst the chief supporters were Mr. George Walker, Honorable Secretary, Mr. B. Smith, M.P., Albany Fonblanque, Esquire, of the Examiner, Messrs. Perigal, Slouse, Popert, MacDonald, and many others from the London Club. In 1833, Labourdonnais and MacDonald played their different matches at these splendid rooms. By the continued exertions of Mr. George Walker, the number of members was increased to 300. What a glorious muster roll! Why should the old days not live again at the West End? Surely the ranks of chess players are not thinned, nor is their strength diminished. Are Lowenthals, Bowdens, Birds, Stauntons, Barnsies, Buckles, Wormolds, Fockbeers, Bryans, Zytogoroskys, Lowe's, Hannah, etc., 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 are worthy descendants of West End men of the olden time, without even enlisting the support of such city magnates as Mongredieu, Slouse, Medleys, etc., of the ancient and virile London Club. Many members of the Westminster still make love to the nymph Caissa, such historical names as Slouse and Walker, for instance. But in addition to the above-mentioned general officers, we now possess a constantly increasing rank and file, recruited from the chess-playing militia of schools and private families. Chess is assuming vast proportions in England and America. Scarcely a weekly paper of any circulation but gives a column to the game, and certainly no newspaper editor would do so if he did not find it pay. At the West End of London there now exists 2 clubs of importance. The old St. George's and the new St. James, the Philidorian rooms in Rathbone Place, partaking rather of the Divan character. Neither of these clubs require proficiency in the game as a passport for membership, and the gentleman receiving the queen would be just as eligible as the amateur giving it. Surely the advantages offered for increasing one's strength in this intellectual struggle of mind against mind should be an inducement for young players to enroll themselves in one or the other of these two associations. When the Westminster had grown up into a goodly body of 300 members, Mr. George Walker began to find that the duties of secretary were interfering seriously with his other pursuits, and he therefore resigned the office and was succeeded by Mr. William Greenwood Walker, to whom the chess world is so much indebted for taking down the games of McDonnell. The club had arrived at its Augustine era, and, in 1838, its fortunes began to wane, the proprietor getting into pecuniary difficulties. Mr. Huttman could not let well alone. He introduced a daily dinner, on plans so profoundly calculated that the more persons who dined, the more he lost. He got the club, also, into a bad odor, by allowing chess to be played there on Sundays. Musical soirees and other nonsense followed. The main object of the establishment thus became ignored, and, instead of new members joining, the old ones fell off one by one, and the princely mansion in Bedford Street was shortly to let. Mr. Huttman's pecuniary difficulties perilled the very existence of the club, notwithstanding that the members handed over to him the reserve fund, amounting to a few hundred pounds. No club can be said to be in safety without such a fund upon which to fall back in case of emergency, as, for instance, retirement of members. Members of chess clubs will retire, prominent ones even, a very frequent cause being marriage. The backsliders, however, often come back, eventually. The Westminster Club, being now without house or home, looked about for some benevolent individual who would take them in and do for them. Such an one they found in Mr. Rees, proprietor of the Divan in the Strand, who offered them private rooms in his establishment. Thither the debris of old Westminster forthwith removed. Each member was provided with a latchkey, with which to let himself in at the private door. Here it was that Mr. Staunton appeared for the first time in chess circles, although he was never a member of the Westminster Club. In its new quarters the association drew out an existence of 12 months, giving up the ghost in 1840. About this time the veteran writer and encyclopedist Alexandre made a lamentable fiasco at his Café de l'Échiquier in Paris, an establishment which he vainly hoped would entice away the habitués at the Cafés de la Régence et de Procope. Coming over to London, he made the acquaintance of Mr. Staunton, and the two players struck hands together, and resolved to open a chess establishment as a partnership concern. Alexandre put in his little all, the change out of his Paris capital, and he and his coadjutor opened rooms at the Waterloo Chambers. A very good locality, perhaps too good, for rents in that neighborhood are rather high. Some 20 or 30 old players rallied round them, but the attempt was only of short duration. The two camarades took to squabbling and vilifying each other, and within a year the club was formally dissolved at the request of the members. All connection now being severed between the members and Messrs. Alexandre and Staunton, the amateurs convened a private meeting for the purpose of examining their prospects and taking steps for reorganization. Mr. George Walker advertised for a large room, and was answered by Mr. Beatty, proprietor of Beatty's Hotel, George Street, Hanover Square. Here once again the remains of the old guard planted their standard, and in special solemn convocation, under a full sense of their responsibility, and with all due solemnity, they christened their club the St. George's, the name being suggested, in the first place, by the baptismal appellative of their virtual founder and honorable secretary, Mr. George Walker, and secondly, because the meeting was in George Street, in the Paris of St. George's. The club was exceedingly prosperous during the first year of its existence, much being due to the fostering care of Mr. B. Smith, M.P., for Norwich, who was assiduous in his attendance, and a capital whipper-in of members. The room was large, well-proportioned, and well-ventilated, cooking first-rate, wines unexceptionable. Wine, by the by, makes your game brilliant, if not sound. Dull, unimaginative Zetten would have been betrayed into an attempt at brilliance and dash with a couple of bottles of Old Crusted under his belt. but it began to appear as though a West End club could be naught but an annual. Mr. Beatty failed in business, and the St. George's were turned out of doors, wanderers for a season, without prospect of refuge. And the devotees of Caïssa were on the town for some weeks, two or three of the leading and most active assiduously on the watch to find a fresh location, but almost in blank despair as to the result. Mr. B. Smith was a large shareholder in the Polytechnic Institution, Regent Street. The managing committee of that estimable establishment were, about this time, endeavoring to form reading rooms by subscription, in the first floor of their building, facing Cavendish Square. It was suggested to the committee that chess and reading might be combined, that one large room facing the square should be set apart for reading exclusively, and two smaller ones be devoted to chess. A meeting was forthwith convened, Mr. Nurse representing the proprietors of the institution. The chess players present being Mr. B. Smith, Mr. Richard Penn, and the indefatigable and indomitable George Walker. These three gentlemen guaranteed that 100 members, paying an annual subscription of 3 guineas each, should be enrolled in the chess club within 12 months, and once again the Red Cross of the St. George's was floating bravely in the air. Forthwith commenced the hunting up of old members of the Westminster and other West End clubs. Touching and tender circulars were issued by Mr. Walker, adjuring the straggling devotees of Caïssa, by all the recollections of their first and early loves, by all their hopes of a glorious hereafter, to rush once more to the rescue. Could such pathetic appeals fall unheeded upon the chess lover's ear? No. 150 members reiterated no to the accompaniment of their 153 guineas subscriptions. Royal Blue Book notabilities enrolled themselves, as, for instance, the present Lord Ravensworth, Dr. Murray, Lord Bishop of Rochester, the Honorable Charles Murray, Mr. Brooke Greville, Mr. Albany Fonblanque, the Misters Hampton, Lord Clarence Paget, and a host of other fashionables. So the St. George's flourished for years, and it began to appear that a chess club at the West End could, under proper management, become a permanent institution. It was in this locale that Mr. Staunton played his first match with Saint Amant, and, losing it, took his revenge by winning in his turn at Paris. For some reason or other, the French amateur displayed unaccountable nervousness during the progress of the match in his own capital. The Baron de La Blanc Blanc, who was well known in Parisian salons as an excellent player and firm supporter of the game, assured me but lately that she had no easy task in instilling courage into her countryman, startled as he was by Mr. Staunton's winning game after game from him. Warming up under the merry rebukes of his fair inspirer, Saint Amant began to turn the tables upon his antagonist, and it seemed as if he would anticipate the result of the contest between Löwenthal and Harrwitz. Mr. Staunton, however, eventually won, and the stakes were deposited for the third and deciding match, but Mr. S. was taken ill, and it was never played. It is unfortunate for Mr. Staunton's reputation that the plea of bad health was so frequently used by him when opponents appeared, more especially as he is the first to ridicule such an excuse when coming from others. And it is more than ever unfortunate in this instance, because the French players declared that, judging from the later games of the match in Paris, it was obvious that Mr. Staunton would have succumbed to their champion if the third and deciding heat had not been prevented by the Englishman's indisposition. And many of them even affirmed that Mr. S. felt this, and acted in consequence. It may be added that the St. George's Club had been installed at the Polytechnic Institute some years before Mr. Staunton joined them, as an honorary member, in compliment to his rising reputation. Mr. Staunton was laid under lasting obligations to Mr. George Walker, by the latter's bringing him from obscurity into public notice, not merely by introducing him to the London chess world, but, in addition, by flattering notices of him in his works. He may, in fact, be considered the pupil of Mr. Walker, and the courtesy with which he has always treated his benefactor makes one think of Labourdonnais's delicacy toward his old master, de Chapelles. It would seem as though chess players, like other men, get weary in well-doing, and constantly stand in need of fresh stimulus. Nothing could have been more suitable or comfortable than the accommodation of the St. George's at the Polytechnic, and yet they got to yearning after they scarcely knew what. The cry was raised that members ought to be able to dine at their club, and they forthwith migrated, en masse, to apartments in Crockford's Club, transmogrified into an eating house on a splendid scale, and styled the Wellington. Here they dwindled away, and the St. George's would have finally disappeared from existence had it not been for the kindness of Mr. Thomas Hampton, who offered them apartments at New Palace Club Chambers, in King Street, St. James. Under his fostering care and the patriotic manner in which he is continually arranging matches and organizing tournaments amongst the members, the St. George's has largely increased its muster roll of amateurs, and bids fair to enjoy more halcyon days than ever. In these rooms Paul Morphy played part of his match with Herr Löwenthal, and vanquished the well-known amateur Altair, in a contest at pawn and move. And in dismissing this now prosperous West End club, I must not forget to mention, for the benefit of those of my readers who are ignorant of the fact, that it was the St. George's which initiated and successfully carried out the Grand International Tournament of 1851, in which the Teutonic element made itself so conspicuous. Experience seems to teach us that no West End club can be permanently prosperous without a recognized professor of the game being constantly, or frequently, in attendance, one whose object is the interest, not of himself, but of chess, willing and ready to play with all comers for the benefit of all. In such a club, as the London, where the members are businessmen, there is no hollow principle of caste. Social democracy exists, and the players play, talk, laugh, and eat together on a perfect equality, be they simple clerks or merchant princes. At the court end of town, manners are reserved, and such a thing may happen as two members of the same club waiting several years before an introduction justifies them in speaking to each other. A professor would bring all these stupid convenances de la société to a speedy end, and, by his recognized position in the club, arrange contests between members of equal force, and thus further the objects for which they are associated. The London Chess Club. In the very heart of the City of London, under the shadows of the Bank and Royal Exchange, and but a step from Lombard Street, the London Chess Club holds its daily sittings. Who would expect to find such an association in such a place? Is the quiet of the chess arena consonant with the hum of busy multitudes, hurrying to and fro in never-failing ardor after the yellow god? Are stocks and scrip of dividends allied to gambits and mates? Shall Lloyd's Capel Court and the Corn Exchange furnish supporters of Caissa? Come along with me to the Cornhill? Stop! This is Purcell's restaurant. We'll walk upstairs. This room on the first floor is devoted to billiards. Above it meets the Cosmopolitan Club, and on the third floor, out of the reach of the noise below, is the famous Old London, of which every player of note during the past 50 years has either been a member or visitor. It is between 3 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the rooms of the club present the usual appearance at that hour. In the right-hand corner we perceive the president, Mr. Mongredieu, engaged in dire conflict with Mr. Maud, to whom he has offered the advantage of pawn and move. Readers of the Chess Player's Chronicle, the Palamede, and La Regenza have known that Mr. Mongredieu, for long years past as an amateur of first-rate force, who gets himself invariably into difficulties at the commencement of a game by his unvanquishable contempt for book openings, but who comes out all right at last by his masterly tactics in the middle of the contest, possessed of a fund of native English humor and a Finnish scholar withal, he keeps up a running fire of wit and anecdote throughout the game, in which the lookers-on join. By his side is Mr. George Medley, the secretary of the club, whose name is also a household word to amateurs, he and Mr. Mongredieu ranking as the strongest players of the association. The latter gentleman has run in for an hour's play from the Corn Exchange, being in fact one of those men who, before the knowledge of the political economy had become diffused among the masses, were styled the rogues in grain. Mr. Medley has just arrived from the Stock Exchange, where, after bearing and bowling, Mr. Slouse, George Walker, and Mr. Waite during the morning, he meets them at the chess club towards 3 o'clock, and they become as much absorbed in the mysteries of the game as though it were the business of their lives. If you wish to see what influence chess can have upon individuals, just analyze the London Club. The members are not men of straw, but sound, substantial citizens, with balances at their bankers heavy enough to buy up a half a dozen lords. Does a Rothschild or a Baring negotiate a loan? Here you will find men to take up a greater part, if not the whole of it. Is capital for a railroad wanted? You need not wander much further. Look around you, and you will recognize many of the foremost of Great Britain's merchant princes, men pushing England's commerce into every bay and inlet of old ocean, carrying the British flag across seas and lakes and penetrating continents, causing British cannon to thunder at the gates of Peking, and opening Japan to the commerce of the world. These are the children of the men who first planted foot in Hindostan, descendants of those who established England's colonies. These are the men, the very men, who repealed the Corn Laws in 1846, established the principle of free trade, and told a proud, titled aristocracy, "We, the middle class, the merchants, bankers, and manufacturers of Great Britain, are the source of all power in England, as we are the source of her greatness." An admirable demonstration of these ideas is to be found in the London Chess Club. The association has flourished with never-failing vigor since its establishment in 1807, whilst the clubs have risen, waned, and died at the fashionable end of the town. City men are too patriotic and too proud to allow their club to languish, and, depend upon it, whilst old London counts a single member, that one last man will, from his own purse, find funds to keep it alive, inscribe on his colors Lataet Sintulula Forsan, and shout with stentorian lungs for recruits. The London Chess Club organized on the 6th of April, 1807, Mr. Augustus Hankey being first president, and the committee numbering among its members Sir Astley Cooper, the celebrated surgeon, Sir Isaac Leon Goldsmid, and others of almost equal eminence. The meetings took place at Tom's Coffee House in Cornhill. Such men as Surratt, Lewis, Walker, MacDonnell, Cochrane, Popert, Perigal, Staunton, Fraser, etc., have either been members of the club or frequenters of it. A good story is told of Perigal, who for a long period officiated as the honorary secretary. At the time, Deschapelet made his ridiculous challenge to play any English amateur a match at pawn in two moves. Mr. Perigal was sent out to Paris to arrange preliminaries with the gasconading Frenchman. Deschapelet soon showed how little he was in earnest, and the ambassador returned without having effected anything. On being questioned at the London as to the appearance, manner, etc., of the French champion, he said, with much gravity, "Mr. Deschapelet is the greatest chess player in France. Mr. Deschapelet is the greatest whist player in France. Mr. Deschapelet is the greatest billiard player in France. Mr. Deschapelet is the greatest pumpkin grower in France. And Mr. Deschapelet is the greatest liar in France." A match by correspondence was commenced in 1824 between the London and Edinburgh chess clubs, and was won by the latter. Two games were commenced simultaneously, the moves being forwarded every night through the post office. On one occasion, the Londoners sent off three moves at once, a half hour in advance of their usual time, and after the letter was posted, it was discovered that the last move was founded on a miscalculation, and might lose the game. Application was immediately made at the office for the letter to be returned, but such a thing was impossible without an order from the Secretary of State. The second letter was thereupon dispatched to Edinburgh, retracting the move in question, but the canny sons of Auld Reekie held them to their first showing, and the London club lost the game in consequence. Shortly afterwards, the Edinburgh club made a similar blunder, but they, somehow or other, induced their postmaster to produce the letter, and they corrected the move on the outside. Of course, the Londoners wouldn't stand that. In the spring of 1846, Staunton played and won his match with Harwitz at the rooms of the club, and in the summer of the same year, he there also vanquished Harwitz, in a contest of 7-even, 7-pawn and move, and 7-pawn in 2 games. In the latter part of that year, and in the same locality, Harwitz and Horwitz played a match, the former scoring 8 games to his opponent 7, and, meeting again subsequently, a similar result was effected. In 1847, the club entered on a match by correspondence with the Amsterdam Cercle des Echecs. the latter having sent a challenge of £50 to any Londoner club. One game lasted 5 years, and was won by the Englishmen, and a second game was drawn. The Londoners scored the third, and this game is considered to be one of the finest and most brilliant contests by correspondence on record. The players selected by the club to represent them in this celebrated match were Messrs. Mongredieu, Slough, Medley, and Greenaway, a glorious quartet who are now stronger than ever. The London Chess Club did not take part in the tournament of 1851, because the St. George's, under the auspices of Mr. Staunton, wished to assume a position derogatory to their claims, nor was it proper that the oldest and most influential club in the United Kingdom should play second fiddle to a much younger association. But they gave a cup of the value of 100 guineas to be played for by the foreign amateurs then in London, and Anderson, Szabo, Szene, Kling, and Harwitz were among the contestants. The cup was won by Herr Anderson. In 1852-53, Harwitz and Williams played a match at the London Club, the first-named player winning a large majority of the games. And, finally, on Paul Morphy's being challenged last year by Herr Löwenthal, this club, ever foremost in the interests of chess, doubled the latter's stakes, and offered the combatants battleground for half the games in their saloons. Nowhere has Paul Morphy met with a heartier English welcome than from the veterans of this flourishing association. Amongst the strongest amateurs now figuring on the muster roll of the London Chess Club are those ancients, Mr. Slough and George Walker, and Messrs. Mongredieu, Medley, Maud, Greenaway, and Bryan. May their shadow never grow less. The Philidorian Rooms. A chess establishment has lately been opened, under the title, in Rathbone Place, Oxford Street, partaking of the peculiar character of the Divan in the Strand. The admission, as in the latter, is either by subscription or by entrance fee of 6d, which includes a cup of coffee or cigar. As the Philidorian is too youthful an undertaking to possess a history, I must confine myself to mentioning some of the principal frequenters, and, considering the size of the room and its age, the establishment may well be proud of its supporters. The well-known Austrian amateur, Herr Fockbier, may be found there daily, with such proficients as Bryan, Zytogorowski, Wormald, Kenny, Healy, and the rising star Campbell, together with many others, scarcely less known to fame. As the Philidorian is centrally situated, in the midst of a very populous and influential neighborhood, and too far from any similar place of resort, it will probably hold its own, and become one of the great temples of Caïssa. End of Section 5. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milnes Edge. Chapter 5, Part 1. Morphy in England. It is easy to understand that when a man, and especially a young man, feels his strength in any department of thought or action, he will be desirous of putting his abilities to the severest test, so as to take that rank to which he is entitled. Paul Morphy, perceiving that it was a hopeless task endeavoring to induce the chess magnates of the Old World to visit America, resolved to cross the Atlantic himself, and it would be difficult to imagine a more chivalric act in one so young than thus embarking on a voyage of many thousand miles, for the sake of finding new antagonists. The journeyings of Il Putino from Italy into Spain to battle with Ri Lopez, the travels of the admirable Crichton through different countries of Europe, are mediocre in comparison with this. But an obstacle stood in the way of the proposed voyage. Paul Morphy was not yet of age, and it would be necessary to first obtain the consent of his family. This was difficult, for, in addition to other reasons, objections were made to our hero's entering on so public a career, interfering, too, as it would for a time, with his legal pursuits. A committee was appointed by the Chess Club to wait upon Mr. Morphy's family to request their consent to the much-desired voyage, and this was ultimately granted. Strong hopes were entertained in England that the American champion would assist at the meeting of the British Chess Association in Birmingham, and for that purpose the committee had offered to place at his disposal a certain sum to cover his expenses. This was not accepted, Mr. Morphy little wishing to travel as a professional chess player. At the commencement of the month of June, the following announcement appeared in the Illustrated London News. Annual Meeting of the Chess Association. It was noticed in our columns last week that this event, the Chess Players' Derby Day, was fixed to commence on the 22nd of June. The arrangements of the local committee are, of course, not yet complete, but it is whispered that they have succeeded in ensuring the presence of the American chess phenomenon, Paul Morphy, an attraction, of itself, sufficient to secure the largest attendance which has been known for years. The date for the assembling of the association was ultimately postponed until the latter part of August, it being feared, with reason, that the sitting of Parliament would interfere with the attendance of many who would otherwise be present. The committee wrote to inform Mr. Morphy of this postponement, and again urging him to visit Europe, but he was already en route before the latter reached New Orleans. I was both surprised and gratified when I read the announcement of Paul Morphy's arrival in the Illustrated London News. Now, thought I, these men who do not believe in an American chess master will be convinced. We'll see if Morphy's games are merely pretty and will not bear the test of analysis, and whether he'll find plenty of matches. I wended my way to the St. George's, feeling confident that I should find Morphy there, and after waiting a short time, I had the pleasure of welcoming him to England. But having arisen up from a sickbed to travel, joined to the fatigues of a first voyage across the Atlantic, he did not appear in as good fighting trim as when I had last seen him in New York. On Mr. Staunton's arrival, Paul Morphy asked him if he had any objection to play an offhand game. Now it is Morphy's almost invariable custom to wait to be asked. The solitary exceptions to this rule, to my knowledge, being in the cases of Mr. Staunton and Harwitz. Mr. Staunton declined the offer on the ground of an engagement preventing, and, notwithstanding that they met frequently at the St. George's, he would never consent to a contest of the most friendly description. Doubtless he was desirous of first observing Morphy's capabilities against other players. The well-known amateur Alter, whose games frequently grace the columns of Mr. Staunton's paper, offered himself as a sacrifice. Alter, however, was not the first to measure skill with the young American. The secretary of the St. George's, Mr. Hampton, having already played two games with him on a previous occasion. Morphy and Alter ultimately effected a score of Alter 1 and Morphy 4. His next antagonist was Mr. Barnes, and the result of their play was, at first, most surprising. During several successive days, they scored alternate games, and the London chess world consequently measured Morphy's powers by this antagonist. Ultimately, the former recovered from the effects of his voyage, and the proportion was established of 19-7, the last 10 or 12 games being scored by Morphy almost without a break. The first challenge which the young American received in London was from Herr Löwenthal. Morphy says that no one can mention this gentleman's name without announcing the fact that he was one of the celebrated triumvirate in the match between Pest and Paris. Herr Löwenthal and the 19th century came arm in arm into the world together, so that he has been contemporary with many who have gone to another sphere. He was led into chess from sheer jealousy, not of a woman, but of a man. At a café in Pest, much frequented by amateurs of the game, in fact the Magyar Café de l'Argent, he noticed that a crowd invariably surrounded a certain table after 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And on further inquiry, he learned that the best chess player in Hungary took upon himself daily to astonish the natives there. That player was Zetsen. Zetsen was a clerk in the office of archives at Pest, and, when the business of the day was over, he repaired to the above-mentioned spot to play chess for a nominal stake, which never exceeded a zwanziger, 7 pence English. Another peculiarity of his was that, no matter what the strength of his opponent might be, queen, rook, knight, or pawn player, he never would give any odds. His game was dull, analytical, and sound to a tiresome extent, his only object being to get through the opening and middle, and then winning became a certainty, for all his strength came out in the ending, and a very good place, too, for it to appear in. Zetain went to Paris in 1831 and played some games with Labourdonnais at the odds of pawn and move, winning the majority. He then told the great Frenchman that he did not like playing for stakes as a general thing, but that he would propose to him a match of 21 even games for 200 francs. But Labourdonnais declined. And who will say he was wrong? For what pleasure could there be in sitting down day after day before the dullest player in Christendom for the eventuality of 200 francs? Zetain was so frightfully slow, even in ordinary games, that he would have worn out 200 francs worth of his opponent's pantaloons before the match was half through. He was an exceedingly nervous man, and this quality particularly evinced itself during the tournament of 51, to the eminent delight of his London friends. But he was a good-hearted, amiable man, never losing his temper, and ever ready to declare that he hadn't won the game, but his opponent had lost it. We left Zetain over a move at the Pest Café. Herr Löwenthal, observing what interest seemed to be taken in chess, thought he should like to try his hand at it, and forthwith pored over such works on the game as he was informed would initiate him into its mysteries. Obtaining a little knowledge, he soon after began playing daily with Zetain, receiving no odds because, as before stated, Zetain would not give any, upon principle. During 18 months Löwenthal never scored one game. But whilst Zetain was away on his travels at Paris and elsewhere, he made rapid progress, particularly in the openings, and on his antagonist's return he induced him to give the advantage of pawn and move, and Zetain lost every game. Returning to even play, the latter won the large majority, but with constant practice Löwenthal decreased the distance between them, although he never turned the tables upon his adversary. Herr L. considers that, in their best play, Grimm would win 3 games to Zetain's 7, and 4 to his 6. Most chess players finished Grimm some years back, but he still flourishes down east. After the Hungarian agitation of 1848, he fled into Turkey, and is now settled in Aleppo, where, as he turned Mussulman, he no doubt revels. Grimm was a music publisher in Pest, and, according to Herr Löwenthal, a man of high intelligence, being a celebrated pianist and thorough proficient in the German, French, Italian, and Latin languages. He was also renowned as a whist player, and his equal at the billiard table was not to be found throughout the entire Austrian Empire. His chess was the antithesis of Zetain's, being brilliant but not oversound, qualities which find favor with the gallery, but are dangerous to one's backers in a match. This interesting triumvirate, Zetain, Grimm, Löwenthal, had it all their own way, in Pest, until July 1842, when Alexandre came there, and then they had him too. Alexandre brought his encyclopedia, or the encyclopedia brought him, and both of them got sold in the Hungarian capital. He thought the idea of anybody there beating him simply preposterous, but was irresistibly convinced to the contrary when Grimm and Company did it with so much charming facility that he told them they were a match for the Paris Cercle des Echecs, and advised them to send a challenge forthwith. The triumvirate were shy at first, then did as they were told, and, to their surprise, the Paris club accepted their défi by return of post, enclosing the first move. The match consisted of 2 games, and 1,250 francs a side. The reader can learn, on inquiry at Café de la Régence in Paris, who didn't win it. Herr Löwenthal's business led him twice a year to Vienna, and on those occasions he improved his play with the amateurs of the Cercle des Echecs of that capital. In 1846 he won a match of Hampe, beating him nearly 2-1. About the same period he visited Breslau, and won a majority of games, offhand, from Anderson. He then steered for Berlin. The city of the Seven Stars, Heiderbrandt, Bledow, Bliger, Hanstein, Mayet, Horwitz, and Mendheim. The first of these paladins was absent from the capital, but Herr L. met him subsequently at Vienna, and Heiderbrandt won a majority of 2 games. With Hanstein, Löwenthal effected an even result, but got the better of Mayet. In von der Lasse's absence, Bledow was incontestably the strongest player of the club, but Bledow was jealous of his reputation, and declined opposing the Hungarian, until strongly urged by the members. Herr Löwenthal states that Bledow evinced the greatest generosity. Having a certainly won game, but not wishing to damp a young reputation by defeat, he said, "Oh, I suppose it can only be a drawn game," and forthwith made a move which allowed his antagonist to escape and draw the contest. Not many Bledows in this world. In 1849, Herr Löwenthal visited the United States during the contest between Mr. Stanley and Turner. With the latter gentleman he played 2 matches, winning both, and subsequently accompanied him into Kentucky, where he commenced another with Colonel Dudley, being again successful. Thence he strayed to Cincinnati, where he met his fellow countryman, Colonel Preguet, and traveled with him to New Orleans, carrying a letter of introduction to Mr. Eugene Rousseau. Immediately on arriving he was taken ill with fever, but, on recovery, he called upon that gentleman and heard, for the first time, of Paul Morphy. Our hero, then but 12 years of age, won 2 games, drew 1, and lost none, and although Herr Löwenthal did not imagine that he thus made the acquaintance of a master whom he would eventually rank as the superior of every chess player that ever lived, Labourdonnais not excepted, yet he felt satisfied that his youthful opponent would rise to equality with the strongest living amateurs. As proof of this, I will give a paragraph from the Era of October 5, 1856, 12 months before Paul Morphy was known outside of Louisiana. Herr Löwenthal writes as follows. Chess in America. The progress chess has made in America is almost, if not quite, equal to that which it has achieved in England. This is more than might have been expected, for in a comparatively new country, men may be supposed to be busier and more restless than in an old one, and it seems to be rather against probabilities that a game, requiring quiet thought and study, should have been developed to the same extent as more bustling amusements in America. Yet that it is so is proved by the fact that in almost every large town there is a chess club, and many of these clubs are in communication, and play games by correspondence. Another proof is also to be found in the number of papers regularly devoting a part of their space to chess, and giving, as the English chess papers do, well-contested games, with notes, problems, and chess intelligence. Among the first in rank of these is the Albion, the chess column of which is, we believe, edited by Mr. Stanley, and among the latest of the accessions to the chess ranks we observe Frank Leslie's illustrated paper. In the first rank of the players in New York, between which and Philadelphia a correspondence match is now going on, we may mention Mr. Stanley, Sullivan, Thompson, and Perrin. We must pay some attention to chess in America if we mean to keep our laurels green. The men of the New World are not apt to lag behind when they throw themselves into any pursuit, and if we do not take care, we may have the next chess champion from the far west. Herr Löwenthal, on quitting the Crescent City, returned to Cincinnati, where he was induced to settle. He opened a smoking and chess even, and was on the high road to fortune, when he received a letter from Mr. Charles H. Stanley in New York, enclosing one from Mr. Staunton. This communication invited Herr Löwenthal to attend the international tournament at London in 1851, and ambition prevailed over cupidity. He, however, got ousted in the first round of the tournay, his antagonist being Mr. Williams, but he turned the tables upon that gentleman soon afterwards by beating him in a set match. When the St. George's Chess Club removed to St. James Street, Herr Löwenthal was elected secretary out of 140 candidates, and officiated in that capacity during 4 years. The Era newspaper commenced a chess column in February 1854, and he was selected by the proprietor to conduct it. Our readers know with what success. A few months ago the Illustrated News of the World announced its intention of devoting a column weekly to the game, under the direction of Herr Löwenthal, and he also edits an elementary chess article in the Family Herald. A fair amount of weekly work for one man, especially when his book labors and frequent play at the London, St. George's, and St. James are taken into consideration. The Last Name Club is his own child, and promises to become one of the most flourishing in the metropolis. Herr Löwenthal did not regard his play with Morphy at New Orleans as any test of their respective strength, but it was not at all agreeable to his feelings to have it recorded against him that he was beaten by a boy of 12. So, on Paul Morphy's arrival in England, he hastened to challenge him, and of course a match was immediately agreed upon. It was first arranged that the match should be for £50 a side, and the victor he who first scored 7 games, but the challenger possessed so many warm friends, all of whom wished to have a share in the stakes, that it was proposed to Morphy to double the amount and increase the number of games to 9. It is lucky that Morphy was not born a woman, for he never says no to any proposition, and he did not to this. Half of Herr Löwenthal's stakes were found by the London, and the remainder by members of the St. George's, and it was stipulated that the games should be played alternately at the rooms of those two clubs. My readers know the result. According to the opinion, or rather the statements, of numerous London players, Herr Löwenthal played much below his usual strength, one gentleman stating that his combinations were unworthy of a rook player even. I was used to this, and liked it. The New Yorkers had uttered similar stuff, saying that Morphy only beat them because he knew the openings better, and I can state on authority that all the players in Europe came to a mutual understanding not to play their game when Morphy was their antagonist. But there was also another reason for the latter's success. He frightened his adversaries, not by his strength, but by his personal appearance. This boy of 21, 5 feet 4 inches in height, of slim figure and face, like a young girl in her teens, positively appalled the chess warriors of the old world. Narcissus defying the Titans. Herr Löwenthal was the first one to give Morphy his due. Before the final game in the match was played, he said to me, "I felt chagrined at the result of the first one or two games, because I thought that I ought to have won them, but now I feel no longer dissatisfied, for I am convinced that I am vanquished by superior strength." And he has since told me, "After the first game I went home saying to myself, 'Well, Morphy is not so terrible after all.'" The second partie failed to change my opinion, but in the third I saw all my combinations twisted and turned against me, and I felt myself in a grasp against which it was almost vain to struggle. Chess players will shortly see this noble-minded gentleman's opinion of Morphy fully expressed, in a collection of the latter's games, which he has lately been engaged in editing. The following from the Era newspaper thus announces the result of the match to its readers. Finish of the Great Chess Match. The match between Mr. Paul Morphy and Herr Löwenthal came to an end on Saturday the 22nd, the American carrying the victory. Although it was universally remarked that Herr Löwenthal's play was far below his usual strength, it must at the same time be admitted that the play of Mr. Morphy marks that gentleman out as one of the finest players in the world. We shall be glad to see him engage with other great European players, in order that it may be proved which is stronger in the game, the old world or the new. We believe Mr. Morphy is ready to challenge all comers. There is something exceedingly romantic and chivalrous about this young man's coming over to Europe and throwing down the gauntlet to all our veterans. He is certainly a very admirable Crichton of chess, and, like the accomplished Scot, he is as courteous and generous as he is brave and skillful. The Era, August 29th, 1858. End of Section 6. The Exploits and Triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, the Chess Champion, by Frederick Milnes Edge. Chapter 5, Part 2. When the above match was only about half through, another was arranged between our hero and Alter, the former giving the odds of pawn and move. In conversation one day with some gentlemen at the St. George's, Paul Morphy had expressed himself dissatisfied with Alter's having won a game from him, stating that he could give him the odds of pawn and move. This coming to "Alter's" ears, he stated to Mr. Hampton, the secretary of the club, that he felt confident Mr. Morphy could do no such thing, and that he would very willingly play a match with him, in a friendly spirit, to convince him to the contrary. Whereupon Mr. Hampton brought the cartel to Morphy, who gladly accepted it, and, the two principals being put face to face, it was agreed that a set of ivory club-sized Staunton chessmen should become the property of the winner of the first five games. Now Alter had been playing for months past those odds, P and M, with Mr. Staunton, holding his own against that gentleman, and he considered that if he, Mr. S, could not beat him, certainly Morphy could not. So confident was he of the result that he told the young American, "Were it not for my position, meaning as a clergyman, I would willingly play you for £1,000. As far as he was concerned, Morphy, too, was confident. Before the contest commenced, he said to me, "Alter may win two games, but he will not win more." And I would here notice his M's power of estimating an opponent's strength. When the preliminaries were settled with Herr Löwenthal, he stated to me, "If I cared about betting, I would bet that Löwenthal does not win five games. Of course there will be plenty of draws, but he will not get more than four." On our way to Paris, he said, "Well, now I am going to play Harwitz, and I would bet the same as I did about Löwenthal." And when he was preparing to meet Anderson, he awarded four games to the Prussian champion. In every instance he overrated his opponents, or, perhaps, I should rather say, underrated himself. The preliminaries were soon settled, all ceremonies, seconds, and etc. being dispensed with. The only condition, that I can recollect, was in regard to smoking. Alter observed that gentlemen could use the weed in the room where the match was played, but it must be in moderation, so as not to render the atmosphere insupportable. Alter gave a capital example on the first game. He sat down in front of Morphy with an ordinary cigar in his mouth. When that was nearly finished, he ordered the waiter to bring him a full-size regalia, cutty pipe, and bird's eye, followed the regalia, and then he left the room to fetch an immense meerschaum, from which he blew clouds worthy of Peter Stuyvesant and the Knickerbockers. Alter was thoroughly acquainted with the peculiar nature of the pawn-and-move game. Morphy, on the contrary, was less accustomed to those odds than to any other. In New Orleans he did not engage even players, or any, in fact, but such as he gave the knight, and much more frequently the rook. In New York he played a short match at pawn-and-move with Mr. Stanley, and that may be considered his introduction to such odds. I was, therefore, as much astonished as anyone when I saw him make such short work of Alter, who never won a single game, and only succeeded in drawing two. I am afraid that this result seriously interfered with Mr. Staunton's fixing a day for the commencement of the match between himself and Morphy. It must not be supposed that our hero was devoting all his time to chess, or that the game was always uppermost in his thoughts. A foreigner, and especially an American, feels bound to visit all the lions of the English metropolis, and Morphy was no exception to the rule. I was almost constantly with him, and certainly no subject was less frequently referred to than chess. I have been amused with the conduct of gentlemen on similar occasions, who seemed to think that no other subject than that could interest him, and after pertinaciously confining the conversation to the game, took upon themselves to declare that it was the single thought of his life, so that, in England, he is looked upon as a chess automaton. In France they give him the very opposite character, complaining of his aversion for the game. Precisely the same thing was observable in their references to the peculiar style of his play. In England they considered him the very beau ideal of brilliancy, comparing him to MacDonald and to Cochrane without his faults. In Paris, however, they characterized his game as solide, close, and analytical, not possessing brilliance like Labourdonnais. Although these Frenchmen, one and all, with the exception of Des Rivières, forced their close openings upon him. Since Mr. Staunton's voluntary relinquishment of what he terms actual play, confining himself to consultation games and odds, Mr. Bowden is admitted to be the best English player. The B's certainly form a strong phalanx amongst London amateurs, numbering such names as Buckle, Bowden, Barnes, Bryan, Bird, but the first-named gentleman has long since quitted the lists. Mr. Bowden was no exception to the rule of English players in their opinion of Morphy, on the latter's arriving in Europe. But he was one of the first to be convinced of the American's superiority, and, with John Bull honesty, immediately avowed it. The admirably conducted chess column in The Field is under his supervision, and his remarks therein on Morphy's tactics are too well known to require any comment from me. I have heard him state his conviction that no one could possibly be better adapted for the game, whether physically or mentally, and he, too, like Herr Löwenthal, ranks Morphy above all known players. In the month of January last, he drew my attention to one game in particular, between our hero and Anderson, stating that he was satisfied Labourdonnais would have lost it 10 times over. Now it requires great courage on the part of any man to place a player beside Labourdonnais, much more above him. Herr Löwenthal says that he does not wonder that the chess world is so backward in giving Morphy the rank to which he is entitled. But few players are capable of appreciating his games, and it was only after careful analysis that he could form a proper opinion of them. He assured me that he has frequently been confounded at the depths of Morphy's combinations, whilst engaged in their work, expressing his firm conviction that when a recollection of his games shall be placed before the public, the chess world will rank Morphy above all players, living or dead. The proportion in which Morphy had beaten Mr. Bowden was so great, namely 5-1, that a prominent member of the St. George's remarked on hearing it, "Well, I did not think any player living could win in such proportion." I remember a similar occurrence in reference to Mr. Perrin, the late secretary of the New York Chess Club, some weeks before the appearance of Paul Morphy in that city. In answer to a friend, this gentleman replied, "That is the same as saying that a player could give any of us a piece," meaning the principal members of his club, who were considered about on par with each other. "Now I don't think that Labourdonnais, even, could give me the knight." Morphy, nevertheless, after beating him at even at pawn and move, and pawn and two, offered him the knight, which was accepted, for trial's sake. And out of 5 games there was a difference of the odd victory, but my memory fails me as to whether it was won by Morphy or not. Mr. Perrin will not feel displeased at my mentioning this fact, because it is pretty well conceded now, that where any other player can give pawn and two moves, Morphy can easily give the knight. European celebrities, in making comparison with the strength of different amateurs, leave Morphy out of the question, and when they compare him at all, it is only with Labourdonnais. And very few of them, too, would scruple at taking odds from him. On the publication of his challenge to Mr. Harwitz to play a match at pawn and move for 500 francs, Mr. Bowden stated in The Field, "There is more than one English player who will be glad to meet Mr. Morphy on these terms." The majority of his games in London, Morphy played at the Divan. It was a general subject of regret, after he had vanquished the different amateurs in the capital, that Mr. Bird was absent in the North, and that the American might leave before that gentleman could visit London. Mr. Bird is a terrible fellow for attacking right and left. His game was described as the counterpart of Morphy's, it being added that he was just the antagonist our hero required. At last, Mr. Bird arrived, and the result between the two was more startling than ever, Morphy winning 10-1. It is but just to state that Mr. Bird was somewhat out of play, as he himself observed, adding, however, that he never was a match for his antagonist. It gives me much pleasure to relate such instances as these, because, as a general rule, there are no more self-confident mortals than prominent chess players. It would be difficult to remember all the men with whom Morphy played at the Divan, or rather with whom he did not play, but I must not forget that merry individual, Mr. Lowe. It was in the Divan that Mr. Staunton played Mr. Lowe, that celebrated match at pawn and move, the play in which, on both sides, as Mr. S. observed, was unworthy of second-rate players in a third-rate coffee-room, because Mr. Staunton was beaten. Since that occasion, Mr. Staunton has slighted the Divan, but Mr. Lowe still flourishes there, ever ready to meet all comers, and if not nightly playing somebody, at all events nightly making everybody laugh. Mr. Lowe made trial of Morphy privately, immediately on the latter's arrival, and forthwith ran to the divan to tell everybody, much to everybody's disgust, that not one of them would have any chance against the American. They all laughed at him, the only reply being, "Oh, lo, you're a funny fellow." Before the Birmingham meeting, Morphy had met all the leading metropolitan players, with, of course, the exception of Mr. Staunton. And yet, perhaps, I should not except that gentleman, for our hero had played in two consultation games with him, Mr. S.'s ally being Altair, and Morphy's. Mr. Barnes and Altair are well matched. Both of these consultation games were won by Messrs. Barnes and Morphy. As the latter part of the month of August approached, considerable curiosity was evinced in various quarters as to whether Paul Morphy would then be a contestant in the tournament. Although not a Yankee, he nevertheless displayed as much cuteness under oft-repeated interrogatories as the downiest down-easter. Feeling what an important bearing his determination would have upon the expected match with Mr. Staunton, in a subsequent chapter will be found his reasons for not entering the lists on that occasion. He was well aware that his decision must necessarily produce considerable disappointment, but he was conscious that a tournament triumph is by no means an accurate test of strength. If chess can ever become a game of chance, it is under such circumstances, and only the sure criterion of the respective strength of two opponents is by actual hand-to-hand encounter. But Morphy did not intend disappointing the Birmingham gentry altogether, and felt convinced that if he played 6 or 8 games blindfolded before the association, they would pardon his absence at the opening of the meeting. After the tournament had got into the second section, he left London and arrived at Birmingham before the day's proceedings had fully commenced. I had the pleasure of accompanying him, and on our arrival at the college in which the meeting of the British Chess Association was held, we found quite a crowd in the commodious rooms provided by the Committee of Management. The president of the Birmingham Club, Mr. Avery, introduced the young American to the members of the association, and the cheers with which he was received were such as seldom come from others than Englishmen. Morphy advanced up the room without the slightest embarrassment, although his reception was as unlooked for as it was flattering. Saint-Amant, who was present, wrote a brilliant account of the meeting to the Paris journal Le Sport, and I am only sorry that I have not the article in question by me at the present moment. The style of the article, however, is indelibly fixed in my memory, reminding one of the lays of the old troubadours. Saint-Amant writes prose and poetry, and he has made of Morphy an epic hero. He tells the Parisians that the young American is no mere pale-faced boy, visiting foreign lands to increase his powers, but a citizen of the United States who comes to claim a scepter in Europe. Then again, his walk is that of a king, and he advances through the crowd of strangers like a monarch receiving homage from his court. But he does not forget to state that Morphy is innately modest, and that all his admiration has no bad effect upon him, for such has been the theme of every one who has been brought into contact with him. Most of the principal players in England were assembled at Birmingham in August 1858. Among them, Staunton, Lowenthal, Bowden, Bird, Kipping, Owen, Salmon, Avery, Hampton, the president of the association, Lord Lyttelton, Fockbeer, Bryan, etc. The prominent feature of the meeting was, of course, the tournament prizes of 60 and 20 guineas, for which Mr. Staunton and Lowenthal, Saint-Amant, Fockbeer, Kipping, Owen, Hughes, Bryan, Smith, Ingleby, Bird, Szabo, Hampton, Breadlestone, and Salmon contended. The 16th player was intended to be Morphy, but not appearing in time, he was ruled to have lost all further share in the contest. It was matter for much disappointment that Mr. Bowden did not enter the lists, especially after the gallant fight he had made at the previous meeting of the association in Manchester. The final result was that Herr Lowenthal carried off the first prize, and Herr Fockbeer the second. And, so far as the former gentleman was concerned, almost every player was both astonished and gratified at the denouement. It was only during the week preceding the Birmingham Festival that the Hungarian had succumbed to his youthful antagonist, and he had consequently entered on a fresh contest with all the disheartening recollections of defeat. A defeat, too,
which he expressed his belief had seriously damaged his chess reputation. Prominent London players had criticized his games with Morphy in an inconsiderate spirit, the almost universal statement being that he had not played up to anything like his usual strength. The criticism on his moves in the widely circulated columns of the Illustrated London News were cruel to a degree, slighting allusions being made to his bookish theoric, etc. Yet this old veteran goes down to the field of battle with unshaken courage, wins two games, one after the other, from Mr. Staunton in the second section of the tournay, and carries off the first prize in the teeth of 14 able competitors. This result proved one thing beyond a doubt, namely, that Morphy's late triumph was the consequence of his superior strength, and not from mere want of practice and skill on the part of Herr Löwenthal. And it also verified the observation of Mr. George Walker in Bell's Life that Mr. Morphy beat Mr. Löwenthal because Mr. Morphy was stronger than Mr. Löwenthal. Oh, Mr. Walker, Mr. Walker, what a rude way you have of putting naked truths before the public. Of course, Morphy was not allowed to twirl his thumbs in idleness, especially with so energetic a master of ceremonies as Mr. Avery. This gentleman soon arranged a contest between our hero and Mr. Kipping, the leading Manchester player, and exponent of the Evans Gambit. Mr. K had the move, and played the opening he had so much at heart. Morphy accepted, under the impression that he too knew something about the Evans. First game scored by the American, the Manchester amateur thirsting for revenge. Morphy, in his turn, plays the Evans, and Mr. Kipping cries, "Enough!" No other single games were played by Morphy during the meeting, the leading celebrities present being engaged in the tournament, but our hero made up the difference by astonishing the natives with a display of his blindfold powers. When Morphy declared his intention, in London, to play eight games without sight of the board, there were very few who believed the thing possible. They knew that Labourdonnais and Philidor had played two or three games simultaneously, and that Kieritzky and Harwitz had repeated the performance in later times, but there was a wide leap from three to eight antagonists. Harwitz had earned a great reputation in Europe by his blindfold prowess, and was regarded without a rival, although many other players, such as Anderson, de Riviera, etc., had occasionally met two or three antagonists at a time. Here was a coil. This young champion of the West, not satisfied with vanquishing all the chess veterans of England over the board, prepares to cast forever into the shade the most astonishing performances of this and past ages. Well might Saint-Amant declare that it was enough to make the bones of Philidor and Labourdonnais rattle in their graves.
I well remember Paul Morphy's first blindfold contest in New York. It was on the occasion of Paulson's playing against four antagonists without sight of the board. Morphy offered to be one of his adversaries and to meet him on the same conditions, and somewhere about the 20th move he announced mate in five, much to Paulson's astonishment, who did not think the crash was so near, although well aware he was going to the bad. Mr. Paulson got such an insight into Morphy's blindfold capabilities that he subsequently observed to me, "Mr. Morphy can play as many games without seeing the board as I can, only he is so unwilling to lose a game." It will here be well to mark the differences between the blindfold performances of these two gentlemen.
Both of them see the boards in the mind's eye equally well, but there the resemblance stops. Paulson's contests average 50 moves, whereas Morphy's seldom extend beyond 30. The former is a ballista, the latter a rifle bullet. What each is over the board, he is with his back turned to it, and there are many, even in Europe, who maintain that Morphy's blindfold feats are more brilliant than his usual mode of play. Paul Morphy, however, attaches very little importance to these displays, calling them mere tours de force, notwithstanding that they appear so wonderful to the multitude. To quote a favorite expression of his, one frequently used by him speaking on the subject, it proves nothing. A young gentleman has lately appeared somewhere in Germany, who, we are informed, has reproduced Morphy's performances at Birmingham and Paris. In fact, he is represented to have precisely reenacted the American's victory in the French capital, playing against 8 strong antagonists, winning from 6 and drawing from 2. There seems some method in this. At least I, for one, cannot help feeling suspicious, especially as the news is heralded to the world in connection with Morphy's name. I have seen one of the games played on the occasion, in which this young gentleman announces mate in 10 or 12 moves, an astonishing announcement, indeed, under the circumstances. The whole affair is beautifully managed throughout, and, whether playing blindfolded or over the board, marks the player as an amateur of the very highest order. Was the transaction bona fide? Now I do not wish to depreciate any man for the sake of benefiting another. Palmam qui meruit ferat. We know that Morphy has played against 8 antagonists on 2 separate and most public occasions, and that the most eminent players in England and France were witnesses of his performance. If Germany does possess a second Morphy, let him step forward and prove his identity, and I, for one, will do him reverence. Cannot that responsible body, the Berlin Chess Club, tell us something tangible about him, and why it is that we never heard anything about him till now? Perhaps he is a new de Chapelet, and has acquired chess in 48 hours, on hearing Morphy's feats. The Berlin Schachzeitung can surely investigate this affair, and enlighten us on what seems very much like a ruse de guerre, an invention of the enemy. But let us return to Birmingham. Mr. Avery asked the young American what 8 antagonists he would select, when the latter replied that it was immaterial to him, but that he should prefer all strong players. There were then in the room Messrs. Staunton, St. Amant, Lowenthal, Bowden, Fockbeer, Bryan, and others of not much inferior strength, and Morphy was in hopes that many, if not all, of these gentlemen would offer themselves as opponents. But he was mistaken, and great difficulty was experienced by the Committee of Management in making up the required 8, who were, finally, as follows. Lord Lyttelton, President of the British Chess Association, Reverend Mr. Salmon, the strongest Irish player, Mr. Kipping, Avery, Wills, Rhodes, Carr, and Dr. Freeman. Paul Morphy was put up in a corner at the end of the room, and, everything being prepared for action, he threw open his portholes and gave the signal, pawn to King's Fourth on all the boards. Of course I am not going to mystify the general reader with the scientific details of the contest. I know that Lord Lyttelton had the first board, and received the deference due to his exalted rank, by being the first put hors de combat, and I remarked, too, that after his lordship had decided on his various moves, he would get up from his seat, walk towards the end of the room, and contemplate Morphy, as though desirous of seeing how he did it. And I know, too, that St. Amant was running from table to table, giving advice to one and the other, with his continual il va croquer ca, as an intimation that one or the other must look out for a pawn or piece in danger. And then, too, Morphy kept on checking Mr. Avery's king by moving his rook from the 7th square to the 8th, backwards and forwards, until that estimable gentleman declared that it was a drawn game, when a bystander horrified him with the information, "That is only after 50 moves. Morphy will keep you there until he has kiboshed the others, and then he will honor you with his sole attention." But the game was finally declared drawn. And, at the finish, how everybody applauded when Morphy arose, the vanquisher of 6, having only lost the game with Mr. Kipping, through an oversight at the beginning. And how everybody was astonished when he stepped from his seat as fresh as a newly plucked daisy, and Mr. Staunton examined him closely to find traces of fatigue. Then, indeed, his not playing in the tournament was forgiven and forgotten. Then there was the soiree, and the capital matter-of-fact address of Lord Lyttelton. His lordship lauded Morphy to the skies, both for his blindfold and other play, and referred to the match with Mr. Staunton, trusting that Morphy would beat every other antagonist but that gentleman. Nothing more now remained to be done in England for some months to come, and Morphy returned to London to prepare for his campaigns on the Continent. End of Section 7.
Tune in next week for another installment of A Radio Lillooet. special presentation of the exploits and triumphs in Europe of Paul Morphy, chess champion. A book by Frederick Milnes Edge in 5 parts.